Bernice Reagan and Sweet Honey in the Rock, the a cappella group she founded in 1973 with Give Your Hands to Struggle. It's from their 1992 album, In This Land. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're giving you a twofer today. In the second half of the program, of course, as promised yesterday, we will conclude our discussions about the Electoral College and is it time to abolish it. And so many calls yesterday that we weren't able to accommodate them all, so we'll do that. We will fulfill our obligations in the second half of the program. But in the first part of the program, we're talking about Hillary Clinton. On the heels of a stunning defeat in the 2016 presidential election by Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton finds herself gearing up once again for a major legal battle that she can ill afford to lose. Many Republicans in Congress are pushing to revive an investigation into Clinton's use of a private email server and her handling of classified information while she was Secretary of State. But Clinton is also at the center of an expansive probe of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, focusing on whether it was indeed a slush fund operating as a global charity. I am pleased to reacquaint you with Charles Ortel, a former Wall Street banker who uncovered massive stock fraud within the financial world just prior to the 2007-2008 financial meltdown. Since May, he has been here on Lead Stories, as you know, detailing highly irregular activities and practices of the Clinton Foundation, which he continues to insist is the largest unprosecuted fraud in history. Charles, I'm so glad that you remembered who we are.
No, are you kidding me? It's been a delight, Eutrice, to be on with your show and interact with your listeners and with you.
I'm so glad that you can be with us. I know you've been very busy. You've been digging into more and more paperwork, considering that as the election came closer and closer, there were some new revelations that you found, digging deeper and deeper into the Clinton Foundation. So what's the status, if you could give us a brief outline of what some of the new discoveries are with the Clinton Foundation?
Well, I'd say one new discovery is that when you really go back to base principles and ask yourself, what is the Clinton Foundation and what are the laws that apply to it, what you discover and what I'm discovering on a daily basis, because this is a big exercise to look into the Clinton Foundation, not only in its home base of Arkansas, but in all the U.S. states where it operates and around the world where it operates, there are different laws in every place. And what these Clintons have done is they have created, I would argue, a bright line disqualifying organization, in that what we really have here is, in quotes, a formless aggregation of individuals. And the law, when you look into it, is crystal clear that a formless aggregation of individuals cannot be turned into a qualifying federally tax-exempt foundation. You just can't do it. The law is crystal clear. You have to be an actual organization, duly organized, validly existing in every legal jurisdiction where you operate. And that is not the case with the Clinton Foundation, and that can easily be demonstrated, as I have already done and as I will do exhaustively come and after January 23rd, 2017, when the new team is in place under a Trump administration. So that's one set of issues. The second rule that most people, and even I didn't know about until months ago, is that under U.S. law, a foundation, a charity must exclusively serve public purposes. That's obvious. But it must lessen the burdens of government inside this country, so that when you try to operate outside this country, it's a tricky area. It's not clear that all activities of the foundation, the U.S. foundation outside this country, will end up being tax exempt, validly tax exempt. So one specific rule that they've definitely broken is that the foreign operations of a U.S. foundation must be tightly controlled from a U.S. base. And, you know, if you don't actually establish subsidiaries in the foreign countries where you operate, if you don't hold board meetings and publish minutes, if you don't actually control the finances of all these operations by way of getting a real audit, then you're breaking that rule too. So, you know, this is, I think, in the end going to come as quite a surprise to the many people around the world who've been praising the Clinton Foundation and the many people, and I'm going to take a jab here at the mainstream media, who have been publishing fake news and perpetrating propaganda about the Clinton Foundation without asking the essential question, is it even actually a legal entity around the world functioning as need be in the form of a tax-exempt organization? The answer is it clearly is not. I mean, there are charity registers around the world and corporation registers around the world where you can check in all these major companies and countries, and you'll see in many U.S. states, certainly in many countries around the world, they haven't bothered to actually register. So that's a big problem. And it's actually, you know, it means that this thing has been functioning. I think the correct term is ultra vires, outside the law, for a long, long time. And none of these brilliant investigative journalists who are, you know, show up at the Global Initiative or at, you know, different other forms of the supposed charity have either bothered to check underneath the legal hood. It's just amazing to me. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's like a modern life version of the Broadway play, The Producers.
You have estimated, and you had taken on major corporations during this period of the financial meltdown. You've taken on companies like AIG and General Electric and General Motors, and you exposed fraud at what was then considered to be an extraordinary level. This foundation and the volume of money it has been handling and the spoils, if you will, of these donations coming in, and what they got, what the donors got in exchange, you have pegged it to be in the trillions, if I understand you right. You've said this is, before we were talking about billions, you said, no, this is trillions of dollars. How does a potential crime of charity fraud to the value of trillions of dollars escape notice and escape scrutiny by any government?
Well, you know, the sad thing with fraud is that the fraudsters who perpetrate these crimes understand that it's easy to get involved somebody in a fraud before they realize they're part of it. And then once the participant, the co-conspirator, maybe an unwitting co-conspirator, realizes that they're part of the fraud, it takes a brave person to stand up and expose it, because you're basically incriminating yourself. That's the, in quotes, charitable analysis. Now, the evil analysis is, and I think, you know, there are many people prepared to accept this evil analysis, that we think of our leaders around the world as honest, upright, forthright people. But, you know, in truth, many politicians quickly become corrupted. And my suspicion, now looking at the evidence for almost 2 years, is that indeed there are a lot of extremely corrupt politicians around the world who saw this going on and decided to join the party. And so the Clintons, and indeed, you know, the Bush wing of the Republican Party, with Obama, have now been in power in the largest economy in the world since January 20th, 1989. I mean, that's almost 28 years. It's a long period of time. I mean, for many people, that's their whole career or close to it. So you have people inserted into the regulatory apparatuses of the IRS, the Department of Justice, numerous state governments, numerous former foreign governments, numerous multilateral organizations. And, you know, they've been feasting at the trough here. And the way you get to this trillion-dollar number in the trillions is, you know, think about the government spending around the world. You know, think about the number of massive projects that have been authorized by regulatory action, creating mobile telecom companies, creating energy companies, and other concessions that governments have control over. And, you know, these different leaders have the ability to make cronies enormously wealthy. You see that in the WikiLeaks cables and the interactions between the various Clinton cronies and various government officials while she was at state. So there's a reason to give these politicians money. You can get a gigantic return on it in the form of this kind of benefit. And you look back over this period, I'm talking about 28 years. Think of the amount of money just our U.S. government has spent and the various state governments. Think how much of that could have gone to no-bid contracts or favorable term contracts. Think about the various weapons deals and energy deals and telecom deals. And you easily get to that number in the trillions.
The campaign that just concluded, presidential campaign, people were focusing in part on Trump's, in fact, it played a major role, I suppose, in appealing to his political base, his threat and promise that he will be prosecuting, or his administration will be prosecuting Hillary Clinton, not only Hillary Clinton, but the Clinton Foundation and many of its operatives. And then it seemed like he backed off of that. And now it seems again, now the cry to proceed with the prosecution is coming from many Republicans. So what do you read of the status of this possible prosecution?
Well, I think that, you know, in the interim, we've had, I think since the last time you and I were together on air, we've had a former congressman, I think his last name is Fata, isn't it? Chaka Fata is his name?
Chaka Fata, uh-huh.
Yeah, sentenced to 10 years in prison for operating a much, much, much smaller slush fund. We still have Corinne Brown, another congressperson, I don't know if she won re-election or not, you know, who was up for election in November and from a special district in Florida. She faces 350 years in prison for operating an $800,000 slush fund. I, you know, hope to stay as far away from as possible from being on the receiving end of any criminal matters. But I understand the way they work is that at federal level, people sit around and they decide, you know, that do an investigation to a point, and they decide, is this case winnable? And if it is winnable, what sort of a message does it send? And the determinations about who gets prosecuted and who doesn't get prosecuted, I understood to be made by career members, not political members of the Justice Department. So, you know, I would hope that come 12:01 on January 20th, 2017, a process would begin where, to the extent there has been undue political influence, and I will quite frankly say I strongly believe there has been undue political influence in the Justice Department, certainly in the Obama years, even in the Bush years, and perhaps before that, that people will go into this record, see what I see. Remember, everything I see is in the public domain. I mean, imagine what somebody could do with a subpoena and the power of the Justice Department and the FBI. Just from what I see in the public domain, there's a massive case to be made, not simply on operating a charity fraudulently, but also on conspiring to create, as we say, potentially trillions of dollars of illegal private gains. You know, this network of charities has never, as I said, had a real audit. It operates all over the world in many troubled places where there are valuable resources to be stolen, frankly, or diverted. And, you know, think about the flows of money since October 23rd, 1997 that may have happened all over the world. And think about the power of the Treasury Department and other investigators under a Trump administration to say, hang on, you know, there's a lot of evidence here. And, you know, once Trump gets in there with his people, and these are tough people, these are law and order people in the main, I strongly suspect that within this country there will be a massive call to get this exposed, to get people punished if they deserve to be punished for the crimes that they may have committed here. But beyond that, you know, we see what's going on in country after country around the world. There are, you know, I would venture to say that Angela Merkel is in deep trouble in Germany as she contemplates her election. The French have got an election. Who knows what other countries, large countries, will have elections. And many of these countries have spent, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars towards a fraudulent charity. And that's not their money, these politicians have sent it. It's taxpayers in Australia and taxpayers in Norway and taxpayers in France and the United Kingdom. And I don't think in 2017 it's a safe bet to assume that taxpayers and voters in all these countries are going to say, oh, that's okay. You know, you blew billions and billions of dollars engaging in these corrupt schemes with the Clintons. They're out of power. We'll just let it go. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
Well, I see that there is movement outside of the United States, a pretty brisk movement, as a matter of fact, looking to get some answers to the questions of where did the money go? Because they've received no accounting for the hundreds of millions of dollars donated to the Clinton Foundation. Countries like Australia, Norway, Ireland, many others, are now beginning to ask the question, where did the money go? We need an accounting of it. And I imagine it won't be too long before they demand, once it's, you know, they do their due diligence, also post facto, but they will find out that the entity that they were giving these hundreds of millions of dollars to was, in fact, operating illegally. And now would come a demand for their money back. And it seems as if the Clinton Foundation, because it has already begun to warn some of its employees that there will be, an attrition at the end of this year because they will not be able to carry out their operations because they don't have the money to do it. So is it true that the Clinton Foundation is actually running out of money? Is this a ruse to give some kind of a plausible argument as to why they won't be able to refund donors the money that that they received, saying that they've done, you know, all these wonderful things, good works, as they call it, all over the world? What do you expect would happen now with these demands and with more and more foreign countries getting louder about questions of this foundation if the United States doesn't seem to have a zeal about prosecuting?
Well, I think, you know, Trump has made really one of his core planks that he would, quote, drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. And I think, you know, one obvious fertile perhaps it's infertile piece of the swamp, is this whole nexus among political donors, foundations, corporations, investment firms who, you know, travel and hunt in packs and, you know, have charitably, let's say, in quotes, blurred lines and, you know, more ominously committed massive criminal conspiracies together. And it would seem to me that, the way the existing law is written, both at federal and state level, concerning private foundations. These are the Gates Foundation, things like that. They have an ironclad obligation to make sure that when they send money to a supposed charity, that it actually is a charity. And they don't have the excuse of saying, well, we were deluded, or, you know, they have an affirmative obligation to check in advance before they send wires and checks or however they get their money to the Clinton entities. These entities were validly organized at the very beginning on the first day and operated lawfully ever since in every location where they operated. And the Gates Foundation has failed miserably at that. They've been involved, centrally involved, with the biggest piece of this fraudulent entity, the former Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS initiative and the subsequent Clinton Health Access Initiative. They're substantially involved with that entity. And Bill Gates is many things, but he is certainly not stupid. And that's the core heart of the Gates Foundation. The highly intelligent people are involved in that effort. They spent somebody from the Gates Foundation to serve on the board of this new Clinton Health Access Initiative, an esteemed man with a renowned medical pedigree. There's no way he didn't figure out that something was amiss, nor is there any way that McKinsey, who was centrally involved, the consulting firm, could have missed the massive defects in the organization or the failure to organize this properly. So, you know, if one wanted to drain the swamp, one could make an issue of, you know, just how carefully these foundations indeed are regulated. And I think, if at last count, there are more than a million U.S. charities, and I would guess that the tax-exempt organizations department, that is the department that was headed until, I think, 2013 by Lois Lerner of her fame, is probably, is most likely, certainly not up to the task of doing its proper job here. And it failed miserably in that task. So here you have a bunch of foundations sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth, trillions of dollars in wealth. They've given the money away, in theory, to the donors. It's sitting there in the books. It's certainly available to fund a budget deficit gap. And I would have thought that this was a target-rich area to look at and, you know, go back and say, what really was going on here? You know, has that Bill and Melinda Gates actually parted with the money that they put into their foundation, or do they still control it? Is it really a foundation, or is it just a holding tank that they continue to administer to suit their own purposes? What's the governance of the Gates Foundation? And what about some other of these large foundations? And, you know, I think there would be bipartisan interest in looking into this objectively and not regarding it as a PR exercise, but instead a mathematical exercise. What happened to this money? Why did you give so much of it to the Clinton Foundation? Why did you step up your donations after the message? Why are you the largest private donor to the Clinton Foundation even now? What's going on here, Mr. Gates?
Well, you know, I have an idea, at least I you know, I discussed it with the listeners, that this was one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton had to win the election. She had to win the election to gain more time to cover all of her bases, and to basically form something of a defense, because the Clinton Foundation, in terms of a defense, is wide open right now. It can't account for its operations. In fact, even the last, the most recent filing, as you noted, isn't complete. And nothing has been complete since the organization started in what, 1997. They have not fulfilled their obligations under the law to disclose how they have operated this foundation, whether in fact the foundation actually is legal, and it isn't. It's not doing what it was supposed to do. The original intent for which it qualified for 501c3 status or tax-exempt status under IRS law is to build a presidential research center and library in Arkansas. Instead, it's into all these things all over the world, all involving hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet we have had no accounting. Are you aware, since the last time we talked, and they were compelled to file something of a report, whether the report is actually complete at this moment?
Well, you see, the problem with that, the way the laws are written, individual states control the filing requirements for a charity in the United States, and individual countries have, you know, their own rules. So because the Clinton Foundation has at least four different offices here in New York State, they're bound by New York law. New York law is super strict, gives you a final deadline of the 15th, typically the 15th of November in the year following, you know, your financial year, which for them would have been December 31st, 2015. You have until the 15th normally of December to actually file your report. And when you file it, you have to certify in numerous places at state level and federal level under penalties of perjury that the report in its entirety is true, complete, and not misleading. And they, unfortunately for the people who signed those documents, signed the document stating that. Those are perjurious statements. You know, they lied under oath again. And they continue to raise money and go onto their website even today as I did earlier this morning, you'll find an appeal for Bill Clinton is offering personally to match the amount that you donate up to a certain limit, I believe. If you do it by the end, you know, the end of December this year, he says they're actively fundraising even now on the basis of false and materially misleading documents. Yet again, proving my case, proving the case of anybody who wants to shut this thing down, that they're unrepentant. You know, with all the things that are going on, this Board of Trustees has not been able to wrest control away from the Clinton political wing and do what's in the best interest of the charity. That's what a trustee has an absolute duty to protect, the interest of the charity above his or her own interest, not the interest of the Clintons. And they manifestly aren't doing that. They've proven they're not doing that. They've proven it in all states, in 100 countries or so. And they've been at this since October 23rd, 1997. We don't need more evidence. And when the switch is flipped and the IRS decides to get more serious than they may already have been, the IRS has amazing weapons at its disposal in a charity fraud case that are not typically available to you in a normal fraud case. You don't have to prove intent. You don't have to prove harm. You just prove that the documents are false and materially misleading and that they've been fundraising. That's easy to do, especially if you're the IRS. And, you know, when the Clinton team wants to defend itself, it's up to them. They have the burden of proof of demonstrating to the IRS normally that they are, in fact, lawfully organized and operated. I'd love to see that case.
Well, let's see what happens, certainly after January the 20th, what moves the Trump organization will make. With regard to the Clinton Foundation, or whether before then some state attorney general will make a move of his or her own with regard to that. And, of course, we're looking at foreign countries that have already indicated that they will be making their own individual moves to recoup the money and to demand an explanation from the foundation as to how it is the Clinton Foundation spent hundreds of millions of dollars they donated to these so-called good works that the foundation was doing all over the world, supposedly. Thanks so much for joining us today, Charles. And, of course, we'll connect again. I know you're in the middle of going through the documents, even more papers. It's a painstaking effort. I just wanted people to know that you're still alive and well. The organization is still under scrutiny, under your scrutiny, and you have more to report and will do so soon.
Well, thanks so much, you, Teresa, and have a wonderful holiday and a great 2017.
Thanks a lot. Well, you know, that's just around the corner, so we'll be back again together very soon. Thanks again.
Can't wait.
We'll take this break and come back to the discussion that started yesterday on the Electoral College right after this. The number to call is 888-874-4888 for those of you who need to complete your thoughts. We'll do so right after this short break. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and we're returning to a discussion we started yesterday that generated quite a bit of reaction, and it meant that people needed to talk. We didn't have time. So we are returning to the discussion having to do with the role of the Electoral College and whether it is time to do away with it, to have elections, national elections especially, have the people's voice prevail as opposed to this institution called the Electoral College, which indirectly, it's an indirect election when the Electoral College votes for the president and the vice president, as opposed to the people voting for president and vice president. And the anomaly here is, of course, that we had Hillary Clinton winning the popular vote by 2.8 million. It's rising every time I read it. The number keeps going up. I think it's soon to be about 2.9, and pretty soon it will be said to be 3 million. She got that many votes above Donald Trump's popular vote. But yet Trump prevailed with the electoral vote, which is the vote that determines the president and vice president of the United States. And there he scored a victory where the popular vote does not really apply. But the electoral vote basically handed victory to him and not to Hillary Clinton. As you can tell, I'm not a fan of either of them, so it's not I'm not talking about it because of them being involved personally. But we're talking about the process and whether, to your mind, it is a fair process or whether it's time to revisit the way we elect, the country elects its president and vice president. Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Therese, how's it going?
I'm hanging in. How was it by you?
We just got a nice little cold air. We had up below the temperatures. But I think it warmed up now. It's like 33 degrees right now. So.
Wow, heat wave.
Yeah, I know.
So what are your thoughts on the question? Do you think that this is, I mean, from what you understand, do you think that it is a better way to go, to leave it as is or to change it?
Oh, obviously, I'm very much an opponent of the Electoral College. And I think the caller, David from Brooklyn, had mentioned that it's not something that we should focus on. And I agree to him to a point. I do feel that there are other elements within our election system that have a higher rate of, you know, election fraud. Like, one of the things that needs to be, you know, looked at too is the overturn of the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. That actually should be overturned. There should be more enforcement of the Federal Campaign Act, which limits the amount of money, you know, spent on campaigns. That should be strictly enforced, because you look at elections now and basically it's all about how much money you can spend. So it's like, you know, it doesn't matter who's qualified to do it. It's like, if you don't have the money, then you're, you know, whoever has the most money to spend is most likely the one who's going to, you know, basically win the election. So there's bits and elements of what we need to do in as far as election reform. I don't think we should focus everything on the Electoral College, but I do feel that it's one element that we really seriously need to pull back on.
But here's a question then. The Electoral College is the deciding factor. So no matter what happens prior to the vote getting to the Electoral College stage, no matter, you know, what happens with the people, you know, sank a lot of money with this candidate or that candidate, all of that becomes moot by the time it gets to the final decision, and that's where the Electoral College comes in. We see that whatever votes are gotten from the popular vote, they don't matter. It is the Electoral College vote that matters. How does that strike you, though?
And that's understandable, but, you know, I think the The other elements that I had mentioned provide the atmosphere of how the Electoral College is going to kind of sway. So even though Hillary won the popular vote, there is still an element of, I guess, how should I put it? There was a lot of discontent amongst the people of America that, I guess, persuaded the Electoral College to go Trump's way. You know, I don't know if
the Electoral College has its own standard formula. It is the electors, that's the members of Congress, and the members of the House, the 100 members of the Senate, 435 members of the House, and three representatives from Washington, D.C. These are the people who are the electors. They decide, irrespective of the popular vote, they're the ones. Because the popular vote actually elects the electors.
Yeah.
So the question is, are you comfortable? Does it cause you to be somewhat uncomfortable about the idea that no matter what the people say, and in this case, and again, I'm not saying this because I approve of Hillary Clinton, but she did get 2.8 million more votes than Donald Trump did. Mm-hmm. So is the system, to your mind, fair working this way? Or do you care? In fact, one of the points that David made yesterday, and that was the point you raised again today, was this shouldn't be our concern at all. We should turn out our attention elsewhere.
Oh, no. It is definitely not fair at all. I mean, yeah, you're right. It is definitely not fair. And like I said, I agree with him in a certain point, but I disagree with him not focusing on this, because this is a point of contention as well. So there's a lot of things that this country needs to do outside of just getting rid of the Electoral College to make this a more, you know, quote unquote democratic, you know, process. Because, you know, I do agree that even though if you get rid of the Electoral College, it's a step toward, you know, doing a fair democratic process. But there are still other elements that I do agree that needs to be, you know, eliminated as well. So the Electoral College will be the first step in, you know, making this a more democratic process. And also, too, you had another sub-question about what I think about the certification of Donald Trump as the official president. And, you know, I've always thought of it like this. You know, these next 4 years, whether it had been Hillary or Donald, is going to be hell for people like me and people that look like me. So it was just a choice between, do we have South African apartheid or do we have Nazi Germany? And I think we picked Nazi Germany.
Oh, wow. Well, quite a statement you're making there today, Henry. Thanks for calling in. Uh-huh. From New York City, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, Utrice.
Hello, how are you? Good afternoon
Hi,
to you,
I'm
too.
Well, thank you. I wanted to throw in my nickel of wisdom here. First of all, I don't think that the issue of the Electoral College can be, my own opinion, can be discussed independent of all of the other things to take place within a presidential campaign. Ideally speaking, it is unfair. And, you know, when I absorbed some years ago the way it actually worked, because I don't think many of us really, I mean, we know that there's an Electoral College, but I can tell you that there are many people who really don't understand it, because not only are there delegates, but there are also superdelegates, which I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, was something that was instituted back in the 70s or early 80s or something, and the Democrats kind of created this because it was to their advantage to have the person that they wanted to win. So, but I wanted to say this. The system that the European countries have, and I guess Asian countries, a parliamentary system, essentially, if you talk about representation, is really much more democratic. Because in those countries, I don't know specifically if they're all the same, but there's a certain percentage, like, for example, they have communist parties. They might go under different names now, or they have left parties, or, you know, there are parties that are allowed to be part of their parliaments, okay, and I think depending on the country, it has to be like 2 or 3% of the vote, which allows them to, you know, have a representative in the parliament. That doesn't exist here at all. So if you really think about it, this is very narrow in a country that is now 320 million people. If you think about it, they have a Democrat and Republican party, and the other parties, there are some on the ballots, but nobody really pays attention to them. There really isn't any proper representation. Even it doesn't mean that you're going to win the presidency, but you have a right to have a spokesperson in that congressional, you know, forum that will speak for you. I mean, I think that as Americans, those people who live here, a lot of it falls on our own responsibility, and that is, and I, you know, it has been discussed on your show before. I feel very strongly about it. America is a very I'm sorry to say this. I mean, it's a very, at this point, the culture, the popular cultural narrative is so inane and vapid, and it's all about labels. And you, the listener, you're supposed to buy what they're selling you. They're telling you this is how you're supposed to think, and technology has absolutely crushed any kind of critical thinking, you know, because it allows everybody the convenience and the ease to go about their lives, and they have their little toys that they can play with. And so they don't want to feel that they are put, you know, like who the heck's going to look up in a dictionary if you have the internet? You could just put, you know, pop in a word. I mean, the point
but
is
I
that...
I want to ask you, though, in yeah. terms of this concept of democracy, as you've been discussing, which fails more, the popular vote, because of all these elements that you say go in, and this, to borrow a bit from Henry as well, who said that it's more than just the popular vote, it's also the elements of what influences the popular vote. So we have that to consider. But in any event, this works on the system of the Electoral College. It comes down to this body having the final say in deciding who will be president and who will be vice president, whether it is also corroborated by the popular vote. So as a voter, let's say, what are your feelings about that? Do you have feelings about whether your vote actually did count, or whether, in fact, you were looked at as somebody not particularly capable of making a sound decision? So the founding fathers decided, we'll make the decision for you.
Well, ideally speaking, as I said earlier, okay, I think it's completely unfair. But that's under ideal situations, because even if I say that it's totally unfair at this point in time because she really won the vote, which I have some questions about, but I don't want to digress too much, it's unfair. It's totally unfair that you have an electoral college that has already decided before even all of the votes have been counted, which is an important point here, because very honestly, I did not know that the counting continued until almost, we're talking, what, November 8th was the election, and now we're the end of December. We're talking 6 weeks of continuous counting, and very honestly, and I have no, it's just my feeling, I'm really questioning all of these, what is it, almost 3 million votes that they're telling us? I don't know where these came from. I understand that there are votes that come in, but that in and of itself, that nobody really seems to focus on, and it leads into the other points as well, is does any other country have this? I mean, you have an election, and you have to allow for a couple of weeks, perhaps, for votes that are overseas, but then you need to have set certain rules that people who are voting, who are not living in the country and who have a right to vote, need to have their votes come in here a little earlier so that they could coincide with the final count. Because if you really think about it, if these additional votes would have made a difference in the Electoral College, then the result that was declared would become invalid. So that in and of itself is a point that I'm surprised that all of these intellectuals, especially the left, that I've been so disgusted with, and I always considered myself a part of them, but I mean, their whole claim, the whole claim that it's so unfair all of a sudden, even though these were the same people, okay, who denied it to their own party. I mean, you can't, I'm sorry, but you can't divorce that behavior from what has happened now. So that if that had not happened and we were having this discussion regarding the Electoral College, I would feel a little bit differently about it emotionally and intellectually as well. But that's not what happened. And
so could you give us a synopsis in one sentence what your position is?
My position is, you mean now regarding Trump?
No, regarding the Electoral College and the role
of
the Electoral
College. I'll tell you. Years ago, I would have said absolutely that it was unfair. There is a case to be made for the fact that the Electoral College did, to some degree, was created to represent some of the states. You know, if you look at the East and West Coast, it's so overpopulated that a lot of states in the middle of the country would not have had the consideration about how they felt about certain issues. So I can understand that to a degree, okay? I understand that that is a valid argument. But you can't divorce it from the rest of what goes on. And the discussion, I mean, we could be having this discussion if, in fact, the campaign was not so corrupt with billions of dollars. The idea that billions of dollars need to be spent during the campaign for a presidential candidate, for me, is obscene, even if it involves the United States. It's obscene.
All right.
It's totally.
We'll have to leave it there. And thank you so much for contributing.
Thank you for the time.
Thanks a lot. Ali from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, my professor. How are you doing?
Hello, Professor Ali. How are you?
How are you doing? The first thing that I'm going to say to you is that you were talking about system yesterday. And I believe that the system was set up to prevent democracy.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely correct. That was one of the stated purposes of, in fact, of starting the Electoral College. The idea was that people felt, the so-called founding fathers felt, that ordinary people probably wouldn't have as good a grasp, a stronger grasp as they did, on what really mattered. And what really mattered was keeping society highly structured and regulated so that it would always, forever and ever, be in their a reflection of how they were thinking it ought to be. You're correct. You're absolutely correct on that point.
So what I wanted to say is that the system was set up by this white, wise man, okay? And it was a small class, and it still is, to control the majority. So therefore, all those votes that we're talking about, they really don't mean anything. They mean nothing. An election, they really, really, they don't change anything. And if you take a look what's happening around the world and as what is happening around this nation, one perfect example of that it doesn't matter that you go out and vote. Here in New York City, we have former Mayor Bloomberg, who went as he's an oligarch. The man is a billionaire. And we went and we voted for term limits. And what did the gentleman do? And we don't even talking about electoral vote. We're talking about the majority of the vote. So the majority of the people agree that the system should be term limit for politicians. He went and he changed the system. So do you think it really matters if they change the system? Another thing that it has been done around this nation is about this emergency manager. The majority of the people, they voted for, let you see, for the mayor. And what happened with the system? They used this emergency manager, Flint, Michigan, Detroit. And you go on to different cities. So the majority of the vote, they were counted. And they were decided that the people, they didn't want this man, that they want who they elected. But they took...
So if you're not for if you clearly are not for the Electoral College, because it's so undemocratic and it serves only to reinforce the apartheid culture that we have in the United States, what, in your view, is the workable solution? Is the popular vote, should the popular vote prevail?
I don't think it really matters, you trees, because this system is being moved around the world. And you could just go to Latin America alone, and you see how people, they vote for presidents in those countries, and this government usually goes and remove them. And you know, one of the perfect examples is Haiti. So it doesn't, I don't think it really matters, because it's just one system. Even if you vote and there's a majority, the system, it will never work for you. It will never. I don't care if it's a parliament. Look at a Brexit.
Ali, we still have to have, as a country, you still have to have somebody who is going to head it up. How will you select that person?
I don't think the system going to evolve here. I don't think it will ever happen. How the system will work for us, I know that a lot of people, they don't want to protest and they don't want to do it. They just wanted to sit home. Right now, I just don't think it will work. What do I want? Yes, the right thing and the fair thing, it will be that when the majority of the people vote, those are the people that you want to put in power, and that's what it should be. But it doesn't matter. I don't think voting really matters right at this time and at this moment. And that is my opinion.
Okay, so what you have been saying is we need to have a whole different conversation about the value of the vote and the meaning of democracy. It doesn't matter, you say, which person emerges as the leader from this process that we have now. What matters is that we need to redefine this whole concept of what does it mean to be a citizen? What does it mean to be part of the so-called democratic process? And that's a very, very valid argument, a very valid discussion to have. But, you know, the funny thing, the odd thing is that sometimes we get to these things indirectly, but we should be getting to these things, because that is the central question, isn't it? What are our rights? What does it mean that we vote? What does it mean at all that we vote? How is our interest reflected or accommodated in a system that is actually designed to resist it? And you brought us to that discussion. We should start that discussion very soon. It's a very valid discussion. I've talked about it, and I solved it by just refusing to vote, unless there's a compelling reason, and there hasn't been one in more than 20 years, to my mind. So I haven't voted. But this is a very good question, and I'm so glad that you raised it. And it's I think everybody raised it today, who spoke today. In one way or the other, they came to the same conclusion that the subject really that should occupy our attention right now is this very same question. What does it mean to be a voter? What does it mean to be participating in what they call this democratic society? That's a big question. And I thank you, and I thank Henry, and I thank Chris. You all agreed that's the question. So thank you so much, professors, for being with us today. That brings us to the end of the program. I'm glad that we were able to accommodate some more thoughts on this question, because it is a very important question. It is a vital question, as a matter of fact, as it was from the very beginning. It was a vital question. Stay tuned. Coming up, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.